I've been meaning to do that for 36 years, but I haven't stopped long enough to count it up. And a fast-talking Yankee from New York does it during the raffle, by God. God, I listened to that. I'm worn out, man. I thought I was a young dude. Good Lord, I'm older than Methuselah. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. It's good to see you. I would like to share some of my experience. If you take the alternator and move it down... Oh, geez. If you've seen the guy that's been riding around in wreckers and police cars and hitchhiking and walking and all of that, that was me preparing for this talk. And I'm going to try my best not to talk about automobiles except just a little bit. It's really been amazing to me, the experience that... I don't know if any of you experienced this or not, but before I came in AA, I thought everybody in the world was drunk, except for a few square pegs and idiots. You know that I didn't know anybody that didn't drink, and I continue to be amazed at the fine folks there are in this world. And I absolutely have had a rewarding time the last couple of days with. The tremendous amount of help that I received from folks here, and even more, than that, with the folk that around in this community, it's just been absolutely phenomenal to behold. And so I'm really grateful for all the folks here and the nice folks around this community. That my car still broke; it ain't a bit better. But I met a lot of nice people. I got. To Milton, George, and I went on the first air in the Mercy. I'll just mention this and get on with the preaching. Milton, George, and I rode over, and we were going to put the fix on it. And Milton and I flew into working, and shade tree stuff par excellence. And George highly recommended we don't ever touch another car. Met a couple of nice German boys over in Manchester, said it wasn't going to take me but about $1,000 to straighten out what we did, Milton. That's really been something else. Let me ask you if you would just do something just for a minute. Would everybody just stand up, and not only the newcomers, but everybody just stand up just for a minute, please? And just stretch a second. Just yeah. You heard the old saying that the mind only can absorb what the seat can endure. I don't want y'all to get to thinking that the meeting's over before it starts now. As soon as your circulation's back, sit back down, and we'll talk about drinking whiskey and puking a lot. That's... It is. We've been going just almost an hour, and it's funny how alcoholics and Al-Anon's fannies get a little prickly about time an hour's up. And I swear I don't want you quitting on me now, because I've been working on this a long time. 315,700. I tell you, I do just basically want to share one guy's experience. I may have cut up a little bit, but I basically got a couple of little serious things on my mind. And I essentially just want to talk about the marvel of this whole thing. If anybody had ever told me that I would be sober 36 years, I absolutely could not have believed that. I mean, a guy as crazy as me, there ain't no way. And to love it, it's just beyond my imagination. My God, if anybody had convinced me that I was going to make it 36 years when I first came in, I think I'd have quit. I couldn't imagine being sober for any length of time and not being bored out of my skull. And to find that I've found a tremendously rewarding and exciting and absolutely meaningful way of life. is just beyond my imagination. And I want to share with you in the course of this, I guess, sort of the ingredients that put that together, because it absolutely proves to me beyond any question that motives have absolutely nothing to do with results. Now, I never question why anybody comes into Alcoholics Anonymous, whether they're sincere or not, because I'll assure you, there's never been a less motivated, undedicated member walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober since my first meeting. And that's just phenomenal to me. And so I essentially want to get into that kind of thing. Now, there's all kind of ways to do that. I used to be bad to drink. And I still can't get over it. Well, I saw that Al-Anon girl doing something neat with this. What'd you do with it? I hate to disappear every 8 minutes, but Al-Anons always are a little more clever than drunks, aren't they? I'm basically like most guys that have been in the program with me as long as me. I'm a pretty fundamental, basic type of member. I'm a big book type of guy. I'm very much committed to the simplicity of our program. I believe our basic text is the design for recovery. That's my orientation. I still belong to a big book group. I'm a great believer in home groups. I'm a fellow who believes much in sponsorship. I believe in active relationship and sponsorship. I believe in service, not only the kind of service that is just quietly doing something and not making a big deal out of it. I certainly believe in that, but I believe very much in the principle of organized service. I think the service structure is our assurance of the future, and I not only believe in it, but I'm committed to it, and I'm active in it. I'm not a trendy sort of guy. I sound Neanderthal almost in my belief is so fundamental. But I'm not really a blinker vision type of guy. I have a little bit of progressive notion. But when it comes to program, I'm really steeped in the fundamentals of tradition. I'm not interested in any of the new dimensions in recovery that have come along. I'm not interested in phase two recovery, recovery and beyond, recovery and nothing. I'm interested in the basic principle of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a fan of specialty groups. I think there may be a role for them. I haven't really found it personally yet, but there I tolerate specialty groups. But I'm not a great believer in them. I think they may be useful places to visit for some members, but lousy places to stay. And I don't care what the specialty is. You know, whether it's female groups, what my experience has been is that when folks go to specialty groups, the specialty becomes the focus rather than the disease. And trouble usually comes. So I don't condemn those things, but I just don't advocate, and I've never sent anybody to one, but I won't block anybody if they just really feel like they need. I'm telling you that just to tell you what my orientation is. I'm not a causation freak. I'm not somebody who likes to cast the net and draw everybody under my tent in terms of where my alcoholism came from. I own it. It's my disease. It's my responsibility to deal with it. And yet, wouldn't I be stupid to think that there was nothing more to it than that? Now, wouldn't I be stupid to think that my early influences had nothing to do with it? And I just want to mention in passing, to get started, just a couple of points that of many that sort of set up the way I think about alcoholism and the way I think about how this program unfolds, where my alcoholism came from. I believe my alcoholism started long before I ever took a drink. It started, I think, in two primary areas of my life. One was in the spiritual dominion, and I don't mean to be critical of anybody's religion, I'm just going to share my experience about my own. I was born, Yankees are an interesting breed. You said six, Fred? I swear to God, that sounded like a bunch of drunken sailors at Operation Tailhook or something. My God. You brought a powerful gang with you. I'll tell you that. I would ask y'all to stand, but I'm afraid everybody would jump out the windows or something with that crowd. I was born in the South. I lived with Yankees for a good while, but I was born in the South. I don't admit it often, but I was born just south of here in Oconee County, South Carolina. Lousy place. That Clemson University is near there, and my greatest pride is when Carolina whoops the dog out of them. Best thing ever happened to that place, they built a great big dam and flooded half of it. Wonder. So I was, and we got out of there when I was just a little boy. But in the South, we have some peculiar brands of religion. They got them in the North too, but they're a little more rabid down here. And my family were aficionados of that kind of stuff, and they drug me off to that as a kid. For some people, that takes. For some people, they find what they need there, they stay there forever, and do a whole lot better than I did. But I was the one for whom it didn't take. So the earliest influence in my life that I think, in fact, was the base of my disease was in the spiritual area. It didn't take. And I remember as a small kid, as a child, preschool kid, dealing with the fact that I didn't believe that stuff, that I didn't believe it. And went through innumerable conversion experiences and dealt with the fact that I didn't feel any different. And started as a child to hide secrets, to hide things that I was ashamed to have, that I felt guilty about. I remember very clearly the enormous sense of guilt and fear for a child to be bold enough to question something as omnipotent as God. And I remember the terrible conflict associated with that. And that was to set up a peculiar, stressful kind of way of dealing with life, where I had feelings and thoughts and ideas on the inside that I couldn't share with a single soul. And my life on the outside was totally different. The seedbed of my alcoholism. The other thing that I mentioned, not dwell on, had to do with my family relationship. My father and mother broke up. He deserted my family when I was 4 years old. And went away, never came back. Now, I saw him twice in my formative years, in my elementary school years. I saw him twice, both times frustrating and troubling experiences. So I grew up in a home dominated by women, and a sort of a random sample of stepfathers that sort of intermittently came in and out of my life. And in the course of that, you know, I grew up devoid of male influence. That ain't all bad. I mean, I like women. I like women much better than men. Never seen a pretty man in my life. Seen a lot of pretty women in my life. That ain't all bad. It is bad if you're interested in learning what a man looks like. If you're interested in learning how to feel close to other men and to feel part of the race, pretty important. Yeah, I never really understood, excuse me. I never really understood how important that was till I had a son of mine. Where are you going, Fred?
I'm going to help you out. I'm going to help you assure you what that other woman did. She put it right there.
God knows. And here I thought you were an alcoholic. That's absolutely just marvelous that you'd think something like that. I'll have it on the floor in a minute. No, I'm all right. Shoot. Why don't you just sit on the stool and hold it, Fred? And I never understood what that meant till I had my own son. Yeah, I didn't understand it. I couldn't understand what I didn't have. It just wasn't there. But when I had my own son and I started watching my son watching me, I started to understand what I'd meant. I watched how he went about learning to shave. when he would come in and gaze at me and ask me some question about why you put that on, why do you do this, and then go in and fumble away trying to do it just like old Dad. I remember the many times when he would laugh at some of my silly habits and mannerisms and then start doing them himself. I don't understand that because I'd never known a father. I'd never known a real relationship with a man. I never went hunting with a man in my life till I was a grown man. Never went fishing with a man in my life till I was a grown man. I never engaged in a problem-solving conversation with an adult man in my life till I was a grown man. And what happens in that, there's an important thing I've come to have an inkling about, that the relationship with my dad would have been where the development of intimacy would have developed, would have occurred, where I started to feel close and open and trusting of other people. But it wasn't there. And so where that should have been, what grew up was further aggravation. You know, I've got a spiritual vacuum and a guarded existence in terms of stuff that I've got buried inside. That's one. The other thing, I've got a relationship non-existence in which I didn't learn how to trust and open up and feel one with people. What it leads to, I'm convinced, is the thing that it's almost a theme of our book when we describe the problem, where we describe it as self-centered fear, self-centered isolation based in fear. If I had to rename alcoholism, that's what I'd call it. And what happened was that I grew up with the thing I've heard every alcoholic I've ever heard speak describe. That feeling of feeling separated, distant from other people, of not being able to feel close. Whether it was feeling better or feeling worse or feeling somewhere else, I've heard it described by every alcoholic that I've ever heard speak. That self-centered isolation. And so that was the thing that set up, along with some other things, but that was the basis, I believe, of my alcoholism. No mystery to me why I drank. Because when I found booze, I found something that erased every bit of that. I found something that filled in all the gaps in my life. I found something that rounded out the corners and smoothed over the rough places. It gave me a sense of adequacy and well-being. It gave me a sense of confidence and poise, an ability to engage with other people, to even lead the crowd. Marvelous stuff. I would have been stupid not to drink, and drink I did, God knows. I loved that stuff. It's the most natural thing I ever did in my life. It was as natural as breathing, and I loved the first drink that I ever took, even though it was not a real nice experience. God, was it ever a wonderful experience, because that stuff did something for me, and I was a man freed, and I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the places they sold it. I loved what they sold it in. I loved that grungy crowd that hung around there. I loved all the hustling and lying and conniving and shucking and jiving. I loved the weekend romances. I loved the music and the noise and the laughter and the violence and the anxiety about what's going to happen next. I loved that sense of anticipation. That something's going to happen, and it always was. If not this place, the next one. And God knows I loved that. And I just got caught up in it. I wasn't a born alcoholic. I was a troubled young guy who found a marvelous solution, took to it greatly, and went hog wild. Went hog wild. And God knows that I loved that. You wait till the altar call. I go. And I just got caught up. And my story basically was just a rush. You know, I was like a runaway train, man. Yeah, you know, I mean, I just got caught up in it. And everything in it just appealed to me. I liked the noise. We were in Las Vegas last year sometime, wife and I. And I swear to God, even though I've been sober 315,000. Yeah, God, I ought to be a saint. I ought to be cured. I ought to never have any negative thoughts. I ought not to ever have lust, even in the heart. I ought not to go to Las Vegas either. Because, man, I'll tell you, I walk down that street and I see those lights flashing, and I swear to God, that just brings back something to me. The pulse quickens. I get tingly. I want to spend money. I want to go nuts. I'm dragging my wife everywhere. I said, she said, quit. Oh, geez. Probably a good thing I live in a town about the size of Monteagle, Tennessee. I may not be trustworthy in the big city. That was me. I just got caught up in it. I loved the action. I loved all that stuff. I used to say, our book refers to associated with lower companions. I was a lower companion. I mean, my God, I was where the trouble started. If it didn't, I'd start it. I mean, that's just the way it was. If it wasn't nothing happening, I'm going to make something happen. Well, in the course of that, I became an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic then. I did what I think every alcoholic in the world does. I crossed the line. Some of us do it quickly. Some of us do it slowly. I did it, I think, best I can tell, when I was about 18 years old. Didn't know it then because I was just a runaway train. I was just a guy flying out of control. I read a thing one time that struck with me that describes it. Now, mine was not a gentle process. It was an episodic kind of thing, just over and over and over. But I read a thing that describes it in a way. It said, the chains of habit go on so gently that you don't feel them till they're too strong to break. And in a strange kind of way, that describes what happened, because in the process of doing that, I became alcoholic. Now, I'm a guy. My definition of alcoholism you'll find in the book. It's essentially a three-part disease, as I've described two parts already where they came from. One is the spiritual thing that I think is fundamentally a spiritual disease. Second, I think it's a mental disease. A mental disease characterized by periodic obsession and very frequent obsession when I was drinking. There's something about my mind, in addition to that, that isn't like other people's when it comes to booze. I don't think about booze like most people do. It'll never be a routine subject with me, I don't think. You know, I get on an airplane, Jim, and they give free booze sometimes. I always take it. I don't drink it. I take it to my wife. Tell her I shopped all day buying her that expensive booze. She knows I'm lying, but she appreciates it. And once in a while, I'll get somebody beside me that won't take it. And I swear, it bugs me. Sometimes I'll ask them, why didn't you take the booze? Don't drink. Take it and give it to me. I'll take it to my wife. I don't understand why people who can drink don't drink. It doesn't make sense. Jesus. People aggravate me. Yeah, there are a lot of people in this world that ought to drink. I mean, they just ain't got... I mean, I know we on hallowed ground here on top of the mountain, but I'll just tell you like it is. There's some people that's just too ugly by nature to just be sober. I mean, they're just a pain in the neck. God knows they'll bore you to tears. I'll buy them a drink. If I just get them a drink, I'll buy them all they want. feel no guilt about it. You know, cause, yeah, that's where our members come from. I just... I just kind of look at that as my own recruiting program. I just... it'll never be a dull subject with me. I mean, it's always something. And, anyway, no, you get the notion. I mean, it's not something I'll ever just be blasé about. God knows. It's big-time stuff. And there's something about my mind that causes it at times to turn irresistibly to the thought of a drink. I don't understand it, but it happens. Now, it hasn't happened for a number of years. I'm one who does not believe that it's permanently removed. It's permanently removed, contingent on my spiritual condition. If I want to see it again, all I got to do is relax on my spiritual principles. And hello, obsession. The nature of the beast. When it happens, you're either prepared or you're dead meat. Simple as that. Simple as that. Third thing, what happened to me when I was 18 years old, I think what seals the deal and separates me from every other drinker in the world except other alcoholics is the physical thing. The physical thing. Alcoholism is not just some symptom of a mental disorder. It's not a symptom of emotional turmoil. It's not a symptom of spiritual dilemma. It's a disease, and the thing that finalizes it is the spiritual. Something I didn't know it when it happened. My God, when you're in the middle of a riot, which my life was, you ain't gonna know it when a subtle change occurs. But when I look back, I could recognize somewhere along in there, I absolutely lost the ability to control my drinking. Now, I never had tried to control it, but I believe until I became alcoholic, if I had really wanted to, I could have stopped drinking. Had some trouble wanting to, but I believe I could have stopped drinking. I believe that no longer was the case the day I crossed the line. Now, the definition, can I take my coat off, Jim? I know that thank you very much. Yeah. Can I take my towel? There was a time. The definition that I like best, and you can find all kinds. God knows I've read 600-page books describing alcoholism. The definition that I like best is summed up in the third paragraph of our book. The opening sentence says, "We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking." And I like that definition. You can find a whole bunch more. Yeah, you can read a little further down in that paragraph and you'll find about hopeless demoralization and all that kind of stuff. I like that definition because it's a pretty pragmatic statement. Yeah, it's not an emotional thing. It's not a grandiose thing. We alcoholics, men and women, have lost the ability to control our drinking. And I like it because it has nothing to do with how much I drank or when I drank or where or who with. None of that. Has nothing to do with whether I'm young or old, black or white, gay or straight. None of that. Rich or poor, smart or dumb, makes absolutely no difference. The key thing that happened to me is not that I was in 900 jails, not that I wrecked X number of cars or killed X number of people. That's not the issue. The issue is that I lost the ability to control my drinking. My drinking started to literally control me the day I crossed that line. And the nature of that happening is that I will never be the same, in the sense that if I take one drink of anything without alcohol in it, I am in deep trouble. And if I got aggravated enough with that car to get me some of this Tennessee moonshine, I wouldn't even go get the sucker. I mean, I know what I'd do. Put a match in the diesel tank. But it'd run then. Yeah. That's the nature of the disease. And my choices from that point to this one was to eat. I could drink. God knows I could drink like nobody I ever saw. That's the choice. And the other one was to go the rest of my life and never take one drink of anything with alcohol in it. That was not a bright prospect for me when I came in. But that's what happened when I was 18 years old. I became alcoholic. I developed this disease. And from there on, it was just a matter of time. I was just a tragedy waiting to happen. I wound up living up north. I lived up in the state of Michigan and just ran my course. I wound up in the city of Flint, Michigan, unemployed, darn near unemployable. If I got a job, I'd hold it no more than a few days or a few weeks. And then sometimes I'd even forget where I worked. I didn't even know where to go to work. I mean, I was in bad shape. 24-year-old guy. And reached a point that I hope to God I never forget. I became just a street character. I became a barroom character. And I pray God that I never forget that existence. I kid around about this thing sometime, but I pray God that I never really lose sight of the deadly issues involved. I never want to forget what it was to play the buffoon in a bar so somebody would buy me a drink. Don't want to forget that. Don't want to forget what it was like to steal somebody's money off the counter. Don't want to forget it. Don't want to forget what it was like to hustle on the street, to connive and crib, to steal, to roll drunks, to do anything it took to survive. Don't want to forget that. Don't want to forget what it was like to sell my life's blood, $5 a throw, to survive. That's what my kind did. That's what I did. I don't ever want to forget that. I don't want to ever forget the demeaning, despairing, hopeless feeling of having no place on this earth to call home that I would go. Don't want to forget that. And I wish I could tell you that one bright day I had enough, threw in the towel, called AA, and found it had been okay, but it didn't work that way. I wound up, as many of you know, doing the kind of thing that I think every alcoholic in the world fears doing, and spouses of alcoholics may fear it even more. Yeah, anytime a drunk hits the road in a car, it's a major miracle when nothing tragic happens. Thank God most make it back home, but some don't. And I was one of those. I woke up in jail in Flint. Jail I've been in many times. I knew everybody worked there, most everybody that was locked up there. And I took it for granted that I was in there for same as always, drunk or fighting or hustling or whatever. And was greeted with the fact that the night before, driving somebody's car down the main street of that city, I'd run over and killed two people. And my reaction is much the same as you could imagine yours would be. I just simply couldn't believe it, couldn't deal with it, and just pushed it away and then gradually accepted the truth. The only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. I didn't want out. I was afraid to get out, ashamed to get out. I couldn't face anybody. Then somebody found out about my folks down in North Carolina, called them, and my mother made what I hope and pray was her last trip to anybody's jail to get her little boy out. Wasn't her first one, but it was to be her last one. She died 7 years ago, and when she died, among the many, many things that I had to be grateful for, but high on the list is that when that dear lady died, it was with tremendous appreciation for a program that had given her a son for 29 years, of whom she was very proud. That's worth everything that I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous, 10 times over. So she came up and got an attorney, negotiated for my release on bond, charged with manslaughter. And when I stayed sober a day and a half, and then of course I drank. And then between July and November of 56, drank like nobody I've ever seen. And then November the 19th of 56, had what I hope and pray was my last drink. Didn't know it would be, but I knew it was going to be the last one for a long time. I was to be tried that day. Finished a little piece of a bottle of gin, about that much was the last drink I've had to this day, and went into court. I had no defense. There was no prosecution and defense in that sense. My plea was to stand mute, and I think it said it all, because I didn't even know what I'd done. They had to tell me what I'd done. And I was, of course, found guilty and sentenced to a max of 15 years in Michigan State Penitentiary, and I knew what that was. I'd been in innumerable jails and lockups and stockades and pea farms and drunk tanks and stuff like that. But I knew that the Michigan State Penitentiary was not Disneyland. I had no illusions about what that was to be. I'd hustle on the street with a lot of guys that were regulars there, and so I knew the kind of folks who were there. But the strange thing to me is that when that sentence was passed, I felt an immediate sense of fear naturally. But the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. I knew it was done. And the next day, walked into that institution, absolutely resigned to my fate, never believed I would ever come out of there alive. Little did I know that that would be the place for a brand new beginning. It's where I was introduced to this program by a rookie social worker that, Jim's not a social worker, but he knows some. One of them did the little speech that he had been trained to give. Didn't know anything about alcoholism. Interesting thing, the first man that ever mentioned a solution to me, I've never looked back. The first person that ever mentioned a solution. And all he said was that we've got an AA group here at the institution, and who looks at your history, looks like you better go. The way he put it, didn't have to go. It wasn't a demand. No, it certainly wasn't an invitation, just a flat statement, you need to go. And I walked into my first meeting, Groundhog Day, February 2nd of 57. No earthly idea what to expect. Sat down and listened to the meeting. Never seen anything like that. I'd seen drunks do some crazy stuff in my life, but I'd never seen them do anything like that. praying, reading, and carrying on just like we were tonight. Didn't raffle nothing off. They needed Kevin up there. After watching that fella kiss him on the ear, they really did need Kevin. They loved him. And then they introduced the speaker. And the guy who spoke that day became my first sponsor. I loved him better than Peter loved the Lord. He was a marvelous man. And the day I heard him speak, I just absolutely could not believe it. I couldn't understand why on earth a nice-looking fellow like that would be in a maximum custody penitentiary talking to 300 convicts, telling stuff I wouldn't have told nobody, the drunk as I'd ever been. I mean, that didn't make sense to me. But I went back. I lived there 42 months before they paroled me, and I never missed a meeting. You know, whether it was once a week or once a night or whatever, I never missed a meeting. And for a long time, it certainly wasn't because anything was happening. I really believe the only thing that brought me back was the tremendous spirit of enthusiasm that Shy Walker had, the guy who spoke at my first meeting, my first sponsor. Yeah, I believe that enthusiasm is a healing agent. I really believe it's a healing force. And it's nothing in the world but the spirit within. It's an expression of the spirit within. And this guy was just one of those rare people that you valued time with, because when you got with him, you felt better. You were upbeat. You felt good. And I know without any question that the one thing that brought me back was not the experience of the guy, it was the spirit of the guy. I believe somewhere deep down I recognized that maybe, there might be something here for me. Didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was 24 years old. I didn't think anybody could be an alcoholic at 24. But I kept going back. And a lot of things happened. I want to mention three basic things that happened. I kind of mentioned how the disease came. I want to mention three basic things surrounding recovery. I know Bob and I, you got me thinking about it today. We were coming back from one of our mechanical jaunts and and we were talking about sort of the state of things in the program, honest to God, I wish I were more optimistic about the current state of affairs in the program, but I'm not. Yeah, I'm troubled by some things, and I think part of it is what we were hitting at today is, yeah, I know that when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a strange group of people who were literal giants in this program. I mean literal giants. Yeah, it's a strange kind of a phase things that seems to me, you know, I can kind of understand old Bill and Bob and those guys who were just stumbling around in the dark, didn't know what they were doing. I can kind of understand a drunk doing that. You know, where they just sort of had some kind of either an elongated case of DTs or a vision or something. And I got to understand them going at that. But then when things started to happen, remember what happened in 41? You know, in the first 5 years of the program, we didn't get but about 100 members. My God, got that many in my home group. You do too. That's not unthinkable, is it? Imagine what happened in 41 when those 100 had 8,000 12-step calls. And then that proliferation of membership all over the country, whole regions of the nation that had not one single member and yet had alcoholics pleading for help. There was an element of people who responded to the challenge. And they were absolute giants. And I'm one of those who is old enough in sobriety to have had the rare privilege of being carried into this program on the shoulders of those very giants. There were only 125,000 when I got here. And many of them were those figures. And we were talking about that today, that when we look around, it's hard to find the heroic figures in our program today. And, you know, optimistically, I'd like to think it was because that role no longer is necessary. Unfortunately, what I really believe it is, you remember a man named John Kennedy? When he was sworn into office, he said, "The torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans." And the torch has been passed to you and I. And I wonder how well I bear the torch. How well do I carry out the simple responsibility that those guys laid on me? All they asked me to do for saving my life was to care enough to give his good to the next guy. That's all they asked me to do. That's what this is about. This is not about some fancy thing. This is about simply caring enough to share. And I worry about that sometimes, because often when I get with my peers, you know, the old goats of the program, what I hear us talking about all too often is what we used to do. And the giants who build programs don't live on memories, don't live on history. They're involved in carrying the message actively. When we become member emeritus, that's a strange place to be. Now, I was at a meeting, I'll just say this about this and then move on. John, I can see you back there, buddy. Call time out when you're ready. I'll just quit mid-stroke. I was at a meeting a while back, and I have trouble about this sometimes. I saw a fellow I hadn't seen for 20 years, and I liked the boy. And so I went over and talked to him a little bit, and I said, "Man, where you been?" He said, "Oh, don't go much. You ain't heard that, have you? Don't go much anymore." I said, "How come?" And he said, "Well," and he thought a minute. I don't think he'd ever really dealt with the question. He thought a minute, and he said, "Well, I reckon all my old buddies died, and I just drifted away." And then he said, "How about you?" And I said, "My God, man, I am up to my ears. I'm as active as I've ever been. I'm having a ball. My God, life's great." And then I thought a minute, and I said, "You know, all my old buddies died too. They're the same ones you're talking about. And I guess the only difference is I got a whole brand new set of buddies. Whole brand new set of buddies. God knows they're coming in herds, man. I can do the group plan of 12-step work. God knows." And to me, that's the difference. It's a matter of staying vitally involved. But the thing is, I think one of the really life-saving forces, not just the giants of the program, thank God for them, but the people who walked into my life with no motive other than to help, are the people who made a difference. You know, this is a program of the heart, and this is the first place I ever met people in my life that I couldn't argue with. These were folks who were genuine, people who cared about me simply because they'd been where I'd been and had found a solution. Couldn't argue with that. Never had met anybody before I didn't think had an angle of some sort. These folks were real. The other thing that I really think was fundamental, I don't think recovery is an accident. I think it's a miracle, but I don't think it's an accident. And it's not enough to just be inspired by heroic figures. This is not an emotional experience. You know, it says in their book, "Froth, the emotional pill doesn't suffice." That will not help a bull-headed alcoholic through the tough times. No. It's inspirational and it's motivational to get started. But then we got to do something. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I had to get to a point that I accepted to the innermost part of my being that I was beat, surrendered totally. I had to do that. I had to get to a point where I admitted that this was my problem, that I had the disease, alcoholism, not easy to do. Thought I was too young, too smart, too cute, too promising. None of that. I had to admit without any question, never mind the world, I had to quietly admit to myself that I was beat, absolutely beat. Today I thank God for every drink that I took, every jail that I went to, every fight that I lost, every window I got thrown through, because they were all part of it. And I finally got to that point of admission. Very important, that's the ticket to membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Without that simple transaction, nothing else happens. And that could only happen in the deep spirit of Tom Ivester. I had to totally surrender, give up, I'm beat. I am beat. Dude, I had a spiritual dilemma on my hands. A spiritual dilemma. You know, it's an interesting thing. I won't go into much of this. I'll just hint at it enough to maybe get you to think with me some. Those of us who are blessed with the Southern fundamentalist religion experience, and maybe some others. I've heard a few Catholic boys from the Queens tell me about this too. It brings an interesting kind of baggage along with it. It's a thing called guilt. The thing called morality. And it very, very troublingly clouds the picture of alcoholism, of whether I'm admitting moral wrong or acknowledging disease. Troubling kind of thing. And those of us who had that experience this one for sure, had a very troubling time trying to find some spiritual solution. Thank God for this program. Thank God for its simplicity and its design. Because the way we approach it, we give our members, ourselves, enormous freedom to believe in any power that makes sense to us. Now that freedom's great, isn't it? But think what goes with it. What a tremendous responsibility to come to believe. No big deal. All that depends on it is my very life. So I'm free to choose, but I'm responsible to choose. The only criteria being I need to believe that it'll save my life because that's what I'm going to have to depend on. You know one of the tough things I had to do? I'd spent my adult life, all of my life, child and adult, in mortal conflict with the hound of heaven. In running battle with the hound of heaven, with debate with nobody there but me, with the hound of heaven. And I dealt with disbelief that I had trouble living with. One of the first things I had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, believe it or not, was to openly face what I did not believe. Openly face what I did not believe. And then was left with the vacuum to fill. Well, then what do you believe? I see a lot of people come in who try to patch up a religious structure that never worked. And say, oh, I'm okay in this area. I've always been a believer. It's been my experience that real believers don't get in the kind of trouble I did. What we call for in this program is belief in a power that will specifically help me regain sanity. It's about getting well. It's not about getting good. It's about getting well. Thank God for that. That was tough to do, to have to face up soberly and clear-mindedly to what I didn't believe and then come to believe what I did. Tremendously important. It's a spiritual program. And the thing with those relationships, I'll mention that in a minute. And we're doing okay, aren't we, John? How we doing? You timekeeper, buddy. That was a start. You know, recovery is a very real process. It's not some mysterious thing that happens that falls out of the blue. It's a very powerful, real, clear experience. I'm more reminded of that today than I've ever been in my life. I'm doing something right now. I'll mention this right now that I've been concerned for a long time, Bob, about the kind of stuff we were talking about and some stuff we were talking about, Jim, about the changing face of AA and about the tremendous numbers of people coming in and how tough a challenge it is to try to work with them. And we often fall into throwing bricks at treatment centers and them and those out there and all this stuff, you know. I really don't think it has anything to do with our dilemma. I don't think the enemy's ever out there. He's in here. That's where the enemy is. But I've been worried about that. I've been worried about the fact, for example, that one man, well, it's not just one man's opinion. Now, if you look at the latest survey of our membership that comes out of the World Service, General Service Office, You tell old timers, they get the old language come back. That's the General Service Office latest survey gives some very, I hope, sobering information. 75% of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous today are sober less than 5 years. Hard to find giants in a crowd like that, isn't it? 50% of the members coming into Alcoholics Anonymous today make it less than 3 months. I hope that's frightening to you. What it describes is a program characterized by failure, not success. I hope that's frightening to you. When we think about the torch being passed and how well do we start to deal with that? We're the generation that's watching that happen. So I've been worried about it. And it takes more than worrying and talking about it, though. I decided to try to do something about it. Now, what can one man do? Yeah, I'm only one man. But by golly, I'm one. I'm one. And I started looking around, just what can I do? And I mentioned somebody about the old deacon's prayer I read that really fits the situation. It says, "Revive thy church, O God, beginning with me." And I really think that's where that has to start. It doesn't require conference action in New York or a board meeting at Mount Eagle. It doesn't require any kind of a consensus thing. It requires one member caring enough to try to do something. So it starts with me. It started with my group. My home group is where I do my most important work. My real contribution in Alcoholics Anonymous is not making talks off somewhere like this. I mean, I don't minimize this. God knows I think the story of an alcoholic or an Al-Anon are tremendously important. Listen to this couple that shared last night and this morning. The power of that. The power of the sharing. The power of the program that pulls us through the crisis. But God knows that's important. Every alcoholic, every recovered person's story is important. So I don't minimize this. But my real important work is done in my home group. I started doing a thing last year. I'm doing the second one now. Trying to do something with the kind of concerns I'm talking about. I started doing what's called a big book workshop. Now, I'll hasten to tell you that's not a big book study. You know, I don't minimize the value of those either. You know, I think the seminars and studies on big books have done more to increase interest and readership of the big book than anything's happened in my lifetime. But getting book smart is not it. That's better than being book dumb. But that's not where it's at. You know, recovery doesn't happen in the head. It happens in the life. I was working with a guy in one of my real, real, real screwball cases. I mean, this guy is... I won't tell you all about him. I'd be on it all night. He's just a goofy guy. And I swear to God, he knows 10 times more about the big book than I do. But he is so screwed up, it's pitiful. See, it has nothing to do with knowledge. It says in the book, doesn't it? Self-knowledge ain't it. Book knowledge ain't it. So a big book workshop differs from that in one simple way. What we do is sit down with, and I'm in the fourth, be in the fifth meeting Monday night, if I make it back. For the workshop, and what we do is use the book the way it's, I think, intended, as a basic text for recovery. And we sit down 15 strong, and we go through the book word for word. And everything we come to, we make it a personal thing. We don't just say, "Isn't that nice? What do you think?" None of that. I always open a meeting by saying, "I'm sure your thoughts are wonderful, but we're really not interested in what you think about this. What we want to know is, how do you relate to it? How do you identify with this?" That's what makes it come alive, is putting it into first person. And then every action that comes, we take the action. Finished one last year, took several months, and I'll tell you this, in the last 20 years, that's the finest work I've been involved in. I saw some absolute old-fashioned recovery occur rock solid. Rock solid. So you can do something about it, is my point. and you don't have to have some big fanfare. I just quietly talked to some people about how they did that, and by golly, it works. And so I'm going to do that as long as I can. And that's where this kind of thing's born, I think, in my early experience. I got started in the program. I started to understand some of the issues, and you probably recognize all I'm talking about. It's the process of the steps. And from there on, it's just a matter of taking the actions and letting recovery happen. I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Michigan State Penitentiary as surely, as strongly as I've ever been in my life, as actively as I've ever been in my life. I worked the program as hard as I've ever worked it in my life right there, and I received the rewards. Nobody could have ever explained to me why it would happen, but I experienced the first freedom I had ever known in my entire life in a maximum custody penitentiary. I learned what everybody knows is that freedom's not a matter of what cage you're in. I wasn't an alcoholic because I was in prison. I wasn't captive because I was in prison. I'd been in prison all of my life, of my own skin, a prison of my own emotions, a prison of my own fear, my own isolation. That was just a cage. And I became a free man there because this program worked. Then I eventually got out. They finally had enough of me, and they released me on condition that I go back to North Carolina on parole. I had deep in my heart a conviction that I would never again go into a place like that. I meant that many years ago, and I mean it just as fervently today. The thirst for freedom is important to a man. And I mean that just as definitely. I knew that the only ticket to freedom I had was this program. If I drank, I knew that I was absolutely fair game. And so with all my heart, I meant to never take another drink as long as I lived, and this program's the only way I knew to do it. Got immediately active when I hit the street, been that way ever since. I was really glad I had some serious notions about how serious I was about it, because the first job I got when I got out, the only one I could get was sweeping the floor in a cotton mill, 10 at night to 6 in the morning. Lousy job, but it sure beat jail. And it was steady and secure and paid lousy, but I didn't need much money. I probably didn't have enough sense to handle it. And I did that for a couple of years, and then was tremendously active in the program, tremendously active at every level, having an absolute ball. And a couple of years after I was out, I got a call from our state capitol. And a fellow told me that they were interested in expanding their rehabilitation effort in the correction system and wondered if I might consider accepting a position. But I never been offered a job in my life unless it was some drunk didn't have one himself. I said, good God, man, I'd rather do that than anything, but down here, you know what I said, there ain't no way. But sure enough, I was the first ex-con in the history of our state employed in something like that, been there ever since. Did rehabilitation for a number of years and then moved in for about the next 20 years. One day I was called, after I'd been there 7 or 8 years, I called in one day with the head of the system. And he said, Tom, I'd like you to take an assignment. And I said, yes, sir, what? And he said, I'd like for you to take over an institution as superintendent or warden. And I swear to God, even though I was in the system, I mean, that's still shocking. Of all the things that a guy dreams of in a penitentiary, that never makes the list somehow. You know, you just don't think, well, one day I think I'll run this sucker, you know. It just doesn't come home. I genuinely said to him, I'm really not sure I want to do that. And I said, can I have time to think about it? He said, yeah, 5 minutes. And I took it, went out, prayed like a dog, came back, said, I'll do it. And for the next 20 years, that's what I did, was run all kinds of institutions. And it was a good career, obviously important to me. But that's not who I am. I'm not a fellow that defines himself by one experience. You know, I'm not defined by my history or necessarily, certainly characterizes who I am, but I'm not defined by my work either. I, Yeah, that's my profession, and I am enormously proud of that and grateful for the opportunity to serve. And I mean, I didn't just fall out of the penitentiary and into a warden's chair. That it doesn't work quite that well. I did bother to go to Michigan State University and then finish my education in correctional administration. I did bother to do a few things like that, and also bothered to work my fanny off for the last 32 years too. I've had a grand time and still there. I've been eligible to retire for 3 years, but Alberta, well aware, I'm involved in the most exciting stuff that I've done in my entire career. So, sure, important to me. Basically, what I am, I do live in a town about the size of Mont Eagle. It's just a little old dinky burg, but it's my home, and I function there in a family. I've got a wife that I love very much. I met her 28 years ago, courted her 3 years, and one day I had the experience I never thought I'd have. Now, I had never really, owing to that sort of self-centered quality, I had never in my entire life had a genuine, loving relationship with any human. Now, I'd been involved with many women, and I knew how to use women and abuse them in that sense. But I never knew how to make a genuine commitment to truly love another human being. And I reached a point, one of the most beautiful days of my life, when I realized that I, honest to God, loved that woman. And ask her to marry me. God knows. I'd been married before, but I wasn't sure why. This time I knew why, because when I asked her to marry me, I knew that I wanted to be her husband. And even though I haven't been home on Mother's Day for 20 years, I'm always doing something like this. We've got a grand marriage. She's a member of Al-Anon, very active member of Al-Anon, a very fine person. Tremendously supportive of the many crazy things that I do. Good marriage. It's a warmer, more loving marriage today than it was 25 years ago. Very grateful for that. A couple of great kids just like yours. Got a daughter graduating from UNC in the fall. Got a son in first year medical school. That's sort of mundane stuff for upper middle class folk. But that ain't mundane stuff for a street character. That ain't mundane stuff for an ex-con. That ain't mundane stuff for somebody that's taken and connived and hustled and beaten folks all of his life. Tremendously rewarding, gratifying experience to be able to function that way. I'm grateful to be able. I'm just rich enough that I'm not eligible for one single thing. And I'm just poor enough, I can't afford nothing, I guess. But we're going to make it. I tell you how I want to wrap up. You know, that I want to mention one quick thing about my father, and then I want to tell you about action, and then I'll sit down, because John getting ready. It's meaningful how this program goes. I mentioned the very early damage in that relationship with my dad. Funny thing where this program takes us. It'll take us places we never imagined we'll go. Some of them fun, some of them not. After I was sober some 10 or 12 years, I'm not sure how long, I got overcome with the notion that I had to go make amends to my father. I hadn't seen the cat. I never had a birthday card from him. I didn't even know where he lived. I'm sure he didn't know where I lived. And somehow or other, I got it deep in my heart that I had to go make amends to the guy. And I said to myself, there ain't no way. I mean, this man never done one fatherly deed in his life, and I'm going to make amends. But what I had to deal with was not his fatherhood, it was my sonhood. What this program is about freeing the things that own me. It's about being free of the obsession. The obsession to drink doesn't come from thirst. It comes from a disordered life. And it comes from bottling up feelings and storing them away. It comes from distorted relationships that are so deeply buried you don't even know they're there. And I finally got through with the argument. I said, okay, I'll go. And I went down to, serves him right. He lived in Oconee County, South Carolina. They fit. Now, this story doesn't have a real happy ending in the sense we didn't start going hunting and fishing and holding hands or any of that. found him and went up to him. He didn't even know me. Told him who I was and why I was there. Then I did what the nine steps says. He didn't have any earthly idea what I was doing. But I did. I did. And the freedom that comes. You know, later on when he died, I was able to be of comfort and assistance to his family. See, the program teaches me how to be a son. He didn't have a program. He didn't know how to be a father. That was just the problem that he had. That's what it's about. It's about achieving wholeness. It's about being free of the bondage of my life. I'll tell you where I would really like to just kind of wrap it up. Now I'm still a tremendously active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wear out the average guy in my group, 25 years old. I'm just active. I'm that way. You know, I'm somebody who believes that our recovery pattern has to match our drinking pattern. I believe that. Or it's going to be a misfit. You know, and I wasn't the kind of guy that would tiptoe down to the corner saloon and have a drinky poo. I mean, that wasn't me. I mean, I was wide open, active, go get it type of guy. Well, I think my recovery has to be the same way. If I don't match up to my chemistry, to my drive, then I'm not going to be comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm that kind of member in AA. I mean, I'm just the kind of guy that just crashes ahead. If there ain't nothing going on, I'll get something going on. Let break my car or something just to... And I think that's important, to be active, to be a proactive guy, to be making stuff happen. When I walked in, I didn't know it, but I literally started the greatest adventure that I could possibly imagine. And I mean that. I mean that. Had experiences that I could not possibly imagine. What's the key to it? What's the key to it? That's available to any member. You know, our program talks about being happy, joyous, and free. It doesn't talk about being dry as a bone. It talks about being happy, joyous, and free. What's the key to the adventure? I really believe that my profound philosophy boils down to one notion. It's simply being very unfamiliar with the word no and giving my life to this simple program. I agree to anything that anybody asks me to do if it's within my power and within reason. I mean, I don't do goofy stuff just because somebody asked me to do it, but anything that anybody asks me to do to serve, I say no. I do this weekend stuff about 35 times a year. It seems like when I get to doing so much that I can't do no more, God just puts a blank in the schedule. He runs it a lot better than I ever did. It's a matter of giving my life to this simple program and letting it happen. If I put parameters on it, if I put restrictions on it, that means I'm in charge. If I give my life to the program, it means God's in charge. He's never hurt me one ounce. And what he's given me is a life beyond anything I ever dreamed. It's available to anybody. I hope you're getting yours. Thanks a million.